Something you might not know about Canada.
Hi, I am Don Tapscott, and before the break, I promised to tell you about the digital office. In the 1970s, the coolest decade of all time, the office was full of strange things like typewriters, dictaphones, adding machines, and mimeographs. Telephones were connected to a wire, so people could only reach you when you were in the office. God, I miss that. Not now! In 1978, the Canadian company Bell Northern Research wondered what would happen if every desk had a computer on it connected to a vast internetwork. Their incredibly handsome staff created an office that used crazy things like email, word processing, texting, and document management. Then B&R pitted the computerized workers against the computerless old school test group. This first ever controlled experiment proved that the digital workers were more efficient, innovative, and effective. And they had more fun, too. And within only 15 years, office workers across the globe were playing electronic solitaire and watching cat videos to their heart's content. And that's something you might not know about Canada. I'm delighted to be here, and I really mean that. And because I think in this room is the future of many, many hopeful things, not just for the global economy, but for civilization. So it's my honor to be here. I wrote a book in 1981 about that experience, and I argued that computers were becoming communications tools, and everyone was going to use one. Unfortunately, my mother bought most of the copies of the book. It was like a study in bad timing. But I finally did write a book that somebody read, and that was The Digital Economy, and it was the first bestseller about the web. And in rewriting the 20th anniversary edition, it caused me to reflect on what's happened in the last 20 years and what of the promise of the digital age has been fulfilled and what peril has emerged. And it was a very sobering experience for me. So I'd like to just kind of take you through that a little bit and set you up to understand maybe a bigger picture about why this particular event is so important and about what the opportunities that you have, not just to build cool businesses or to change some things, but really to be part of a huge transformation as we move into the second era of the digital age. In the book, I said, this is an age of vast opportunity and all kinds of wonderful things are going to occur, and of course it did. But I also said there's a dark side. And I went through eight things that could happen. I can't go through all of them today, but let me just describe a few of them. I talked about dislocation of labor markets, old industries and jobs disappearing. I said technology could contribute to unemployment. Well, there's a next wave of machine learning and automation. Report in the UK said we'll wipe out 30% of the UK workforce in the next 25 years. I said, it's possible that all the data from this digital age will be captured by powerful intermediaries and forces, and that they'll create a new asset class, perhaps being greater than previous asset classes like land or under the agrarian economy or physical plant. And that one upshot of that would be that we could lose our basic right to privacy. And of course, that's happening today. We have what I call data frackers. You know, in oil and gas, you have fracking. And these are companies that are able to drive steam into the internet, if you like, and to generate all kinds of massive data that they control and own. Now, some of this is kind of cool. It's a company called Dataminer that goes out onto Twitter and it analyzes tweets and it spots something, the sound of an explosion. It detects 1, 2, 3, 4 pattern detected. The bitstream goes to CNN And they're on the case because they know that an explosion has occurred before anybody else. Now, a dark side of that is that this has disrupted capital markets because companies using data miner can go on and find out that, say, Home Depot had a big security violation and they short the company because they know 24 hours before anybody else. But the bigger problem is that somehow we all did a deal with these powerful social media companies to give away our data. And people, a friend of mine named Jeff Jarvis, wrote a book called Public Parts, and he argues, well, this is great. Transparency is not just for individuals or corporations, it's for individuals. And if we all give away all our data and we all just open the kimono, the world will be a better place. We won't cheat on our spouses and so on. And I think this is not only foolish, it's a dangerous concept. Because privacy is the foundation of a free society, and our identities need to be managed responsibly. And this is a big problem for us all today. In the digital economy, I conjured up this view of Orwell and Big Brother is watching you. In hindsight, I don't think that was the right analogy. It's more like Franz Kafka and the trial, you know, where you're charged with something, you don't know who your accuser is, you don't know what the evidence against you is, but all of a sudden, you don't get that dream job, or you can't get across the border. So this is a big problem. Thirdly, I said, it's possible that we could have wealth creation, but we wouldn't have prosperity. And of course, this is what I said back then. This is now occurring. For the first time in modern history, in the developed world, the 51st percentile is not getting ahead. It's falling behind. And everywhere, people are talking about the problem of social inequality to the point that the best-selling management book and the winner of the Financial Times McKinsey Award for Best Business Book last year was written essentially by a guy who's a Marxist who argues that capitalism is totally broken and is at the heart of irreversible social inequality. This is not good. This is a big problem. How can this be? Well, I was talking to Tim Berners-Lee about this, and he said, it's true, we have this wonderful peer-to-peer technology. You may remember people like me saying, yeah, the old media is centralized, it's one way, it's controlled by powerful forces, and everybody out there is a passive recipient. The new media is distributed, it's interactive, it's one-to-one, it's many-to-many, it has this awesome neutrality, it will be what we want it to be. Well, says Tim, this beautiful distributed platform for the communication of information, not value, information, got laid on top of a society that's anything but. And now we have asymmetrical benefit. So the rich are getting richer, and we've now got these powerful data frackers that end up owning our data, but also creating wealth, but not prosperity. Just another one, I said, I think many governments are slow to comprehend, may be slow to comprehend the shift. And that basically occurred. That have governments changed fundamentally in the last 20 years? I mean, sure, they're delivering services electronically, but the deep structure and architecture of government is still pretty much the same. So there have been some initial stuff. Government is a platform. Government's releasing raw data and creating a platform whereby the private sector, civil society, other government agencies can self-organize to create public value. But it's been very limited. And when it comes to democracy, I argued, you know, we can move to a second era of democracy with the internet, where the first era we had representative institutions, but there was a weak public mandate and citizens were inert. We could create a second era based on stronger representation, more transparency, so that big money doesn't control the democratic process, and with a culture of public deliberation and active citizenship. Is that what's happened? Well, hardly. If anything, governments have used technology in a totally cynical way to reinforce existing power structures. And we now have nothing less than a crisis of legitimacy of our democratic institutions. And this is worrisome. So you see the guy in the middle there, I'm sad to say, that's the former mayor of Toronto, where I live, Rob Ford. Now, the problem with Rob Ford was not just that he was a crackhead criminal, who was also racist, sexist, homophobic, and hung out with the low lifes of the city. The problem is a lot of young people said, yeah, he's a total idiot, and City Hall's full of crap, and I'm not even going to vote. And if young people turn away from democracy, this is a big problem. This is at Davos a couple of years ago, and I was on a panel on citizen engagement. And I was, you know, I was saying, we have to fix this. Look at the US Congress. 92% of the American population wants to see background checks for firearms, but Congress can't do anything about that. And I said, if we don't fix this, there, you know, more and more young people are agreeing with the bumper sticker, don't vote, it only encourages them. And we're going to have a social explosion that'll make the 1960s look like kids' stuff. Well, I get stopped by a guy in the panel who created a VAAZ. You know, A-V-A-A-Z. It's a little network with 34 million young people who want to change the world. And he says, hold it, Don, I don't get your point. Why is it a crisis if all around the world a new generation of young people think that our fossilized institutions of democracy are bankrupt? And I'm like, you know, Bob Dylan, there's something going on here and you don't know what it is. This is a big problem. And the internet has not contributed to solving this problem, it's made it worse. Because politicians have basically used this technology to help them entrench power and in many countries move towards a surveillance society. These are protests in the world, going back to my first book in 81. 20 years ago, there were 6,000 protests. Last year, there were 260,000. So we're moving into a social explosion territory here. As we told young people, you work hard, you stay out of trouble, you be a good kid, you graduate, you can have a prosperous life. Well, I'm not going to say my generation lied, but I don't think we got it right. So the stakes here are very, very high. Now, this is Obama. We had great hope for him. I learned about this when somebody said, check out mybarackobama.com, your book, Wickonomics, is one down from the homepage. And he's saying, yeah, we believe in the Wickonomics, and I'm asking you to believe not just in my ability to bring about real change in Washington, I'm asking you to believe in yours. And I looked at this thing, and it was like, well, my first reaction was, I am the man. but not so fast, Don, because it turns out I'm not the man. There was a Wickonomics community. There's also a single moms for daycare community and a young firefighters community, created a platform where by 35,000 communities self-organized, that brought them to power. So in the next election, I went to them and I said, cool, what are you going to do now with mybarackobama.com? They said, we're killing it. I said, why? It's an opportunity to engage all these. He said, we don't need that. We got big data. We can target swing voters in all the states, all the swing states. And they went from yes, we can, to we know you. And then in the it worked. They got elected in the next election, the midterm election. Youth voting was the lowest in 70 years, some people say maybe ever. So we have a burning platform for change. Now, enter into the next era of the internet. I think we're getting another kick at the can. And it started, you know, with Bitcoin. And I confess to be a late awakener on this. It was just a little over, you know, 2.5 years ago, I started thinking, whoa, could this be the real deal? Could this be this thing that we've been looking for? And of course, the underlying technology of Bitcoin enables peer-to-peer exchange, not just of information, but of value. Now, that doesn't mean that this dream of a true peer-to-peer society and of prosperity can be created, but we're getting another kick at the can. And that's why what you're doing is so important. This is not just about creating some cool businesses. To me, this is dealing with a world that's too unprosperous, it's too unjust, it's too unsustainable and it's too conflicted. And we now have an opportunity to do something about that. Well, the economists, bless their hearts, got involved with the cover story last week. I'm not sure they totally nailed it, but we're moving the ball forward here. And of course, I'm hopeful the ball will seriously get moved forward in April when this book comes out. By the way, if you want to get this book, pre-order it. The very best way to do it is in massive volume. Christmas is coming soon. No, but just to really confuse things, along with the publisher, they've changed the name of the book. So a week from now, it won't be this on Amazon. It'll be called Blockchain Revolution. Which, you know, what the heck? Trust Protocol is kind of cool. I thought it was a riff off the God Protocol from Nick Szabo's article of very long ago. But it will be called Blockchain Revolution. Now, of course, there's a huge battle that's shaping up, right? Will the financial services industry, this Rube Goldbergian industry, you tap something in Starbucks and then these bits flow through seven computer systems, some of them being 1970s mainframes, and finally, like, 2 or 3 days later, the thing gets settled. There's an obvious opportunity in R3. You know, it's a coalition of 22 banks. They want to use this not to disrupt financial services, but to eliminate all of that, so we're all looking at the same ledger, and there is no settlement. The transaction occurs, and it's done. The settlement is zero, you know, milliseconds, as opposed to 3 days. And these are all the things that the banks do. Now, we went through and dissected all of these in the book. Each of these is a whole story, talking about both the opportunity to disintermediate traditional financial services institutions, because that's what they do. They move money, they store money, they exchange money, they account for value, and so on. But also how the industry could use this to transform itself. So let me try and pull this together. How long do I have, by the way? Okay. What does all this mean? Well, I think this guy holds the key to everything. Ronald Coase, Nobel Prize winning economist. And 80 years ago, he never wrote about the internet, and he died before you guys really came on the scene. But 80 years ago, he wrote a Nobel Prize winning paper where he asked a deceptively simple question. He said, why does the firm exist? If Adam Smith is right, the open market's the best mechanism to determine how goods and information and money and people are allocated in an economy, why aren't we all independent contractors? Why do we have firms? And he said the answer is, and he won a Nobel Prize for saying this, the answer is transaction costs. And he defined that broadly. The cost of search, he said, 80 years ago. The cost of finding all the right information in an open economy, the right people to do something, totally prohibitive, so we bring it inside the boundaries of a corporation, where we have stuff like filing cabinets to get information, org charts to find people. And the big industrialists understood this. So Henry Ford had within the boundaries of the Ford Motor Company a power plant, steel mill, shipping company, glass factory. Why? Because the cost of transactions in an open market were greater than the cost of doing things inside the boundaries of Ford. So back in the day, 1990, we started calling this, saying that the boundaries of corporations are becoming more porous. And then with the internet, some vertically integrated companies began to unbundle into networks. Cisco figured this out, and a network business model, it's a 15-year-old diagram of the Cisco business ecosystem. Cisco figured this out. And a network business model conferred competitive advantage because the tonic of the market got brought to bear on all these different parts of the organization. Now, with the internet initially moving from a platform for the presentation of content with HTML to becoming more a computational platform with, you know, XML and SOAP and UDDI and all this sort of lingua franca for distributed computing. Now, with blockchain technologies, the opportunity exists to drop those transaction costs so much that we can actually start to envisage radical new models of how we orchestrate capability in society to innovate, to create goods and services, and to engage with the rest of the world. So everyone's thinking, well, a big solution to the problem of social inequality is redistribution of wealth. Well, we're probably going to have to do some of that. But what if we had a different approach, which was not redistribution, it was distribution? What if we started enabling millions and tens of millions and maybe hundreds of millions of people around the world to participate in the creation of companies? They might only have $10 to contribute, but they end up being owners of a highly distributed and networked type enterprise. Well, this is pretty exciting, and it holds the key to a lot of problems. So I don't have time to tell that. Too bad. It's a great story. So the old is Uber. I love the disruptive economy. You know, I love it. Somebody, I was at a thing yesterday, and somebody said Uber is a sharing economy company, and I'm like, what? Uber is a $45 billion corporation that's a service aggregator, and I get my view of sharing from preschoolers. You ask a 3-year-old, if I give you one of my cookies, is that sharing? The kid, yeah, that's sharing. If I give you a cookie, but you have to give me some money, is that sharing? No, that's mean. So what is blockchain Uber? Call it super Uber, or super, as we said in the book. What does that look like? Well, I'm sure you all know, we actually, with some help from Joan, the consensus folks, we detailed this quite a bit in the book. And how does this actually work? And how do transactions flow, and what kind of technology enables this to occur? But it's not a $45 billion corporation, it's a distributed app. This is all about the creators of value receiving the value that they create. I was with Imogen Heap at her, it's actually her son Scout's one-year birthday party a couple of nights ago in a barn somewhere outside of London. And the musicians have been getting screwed for years. Originally, with the labels, they got a small piece of the value, and then the internet made it worse because it brought these new intermediaries in, like Apple and Spotify, that took more of the value, and the poor musicians are at the end of the food chain getting this paltry little piece. Well, what if we had a music industry that was kind of like a distributed app, and you post your music up there, and you got specifying the rights, you want to listen to it for free, cool. No problem. You want to remix it? Well, here's a smart contract that governs that. You want to put it into a movie? Got a smart contract here, and every time it plays, you get a little royalty stream. This holds the possibility for a 21st century music industry where finally musicians can make a living creating their music. How exciting is that? Old Airbnb. The new is Be Airbnb. Blockchain Airbnb, it's a distributed app. And yeah, well, how about Airbnb covers insurance? Okay, you know, for less than 1% of the total cost, we can build in insurance and marketing and all the rest. And rather than Airbnb taking, you know, 15 or 20% off the top, oh, and if you're international, losing another 8% through foreign exchange stuff, anytime Western Union gets involved, bad things are gonna happen. So, well, now that we're on that, how about Anna Lee Domingo? It's a great story in the book. Filipino nanny who used to get on a bus for 2 hours every month to go pay her remittances. Western Union would take roughly 10% of her $200, and it takes 3 to 6 days to get there. Now, using Abra, it happens in a millisecond. And it costs her like half a percent. So this is pretty cool. How about, do you know that 70% of land in the world, if you own a little piece of land somewhere and you have a piece of paper, that's threatened. Because You can have a little piece of paper saying, I own this little house in Honduras, and some dictator comes in and says, no, you don't. Central computer system says my friends own it. Well, so using Factum, now we're putting land registries on the blockchain. Good luck, dictator. If any of you, by the way, are tyrants or dictators, I would seriously recommend some career planning on that. You know, the old surveillance society, the new, that's a weird picture. Is that my body? Anyway, the weird is a, or the new is a, you know, distributed avatar. Right now there's the virtual you, you know, there's the virtual Joe. And, but Joe doesn't own that. It's owned by these big data frackers. What if you owned the virtual you? It was your identity in a black box and it went around and it disclosed just whatever it needed to do a transaction. And you pay for something and there's no data trail that you paid for it. Plus, you not only get to protect your privacy, you get to collect this data. Maybe you decide you want to monetize it. So I wanted to end just with a thought about you and how this meeting, I think, fits in. We have a lot of problems in the world. And this is pollution flows in the world. You think pollution is a local problem? It's not. Most of these problems are not getting better. So why is that? Are they just too hard to solve? Maybe our model's wrong. What's our model? Anyone hear of Bretton Woods? 1944, the winners of the World War, 44 countries got together and they created the World Bank and the IMF. A year later, a bigger group created the UN. A year later, the UNESCO and then the GATT and the WTO and the G8 and the G20, global institutions based on nation states. Well, there's a new model emerging. And about a year ago, I finished a big study, $4 million study on this new model. It was sponsored by all of these companies. And we said, the new model is called multi-stakeholder networks. And they've got individual companies, civil society, governments. They're addressing a global problem. They use technology, but they're not controlled by states. So it turns out there are 10 types of these networks. And the one that's most relevant to today, it's called a governance network. There are now things on planet Earth that are governed by an ecosystem, not by states. So the internet itself has standards as part of that governance network. The IETF, the W3 consortium, has operational networks that just do stuff. ICANN delivers domain names. It's got policy networks like the Internet Governance Forum. There are advocacy networks like the Electronic Frontier Foundation. What we need today is a governance network, not big G government, a self-organizing set of governance networks around blockchain technologies. I think in this room, you're creating a platform, but you're also an operational delivery network in that you're not just advocating or talking about it or developing policy, you're actually building stuff. And so that's where you fit into the big picture. Now, we have a lot of work to do, and right now, it's the Wild West out there when it comes to blockchain technologies. But we're starting to get better processes to deal with stuff like block size and so on, but we have a long way to go. So if I could just, do we have that? Was there, oh, too bad. I had a scintillating video there at the end, but I think I'm out of time anyway, aren't I? Yeah, okay. It was about something called the murmuration. Go on to the Google and ask the Google, and it will tell you. But it's about starlings over the moors of England, and it's about self-organization and about creating ecosystem. It's a great natural analogy for the opportunity that you have. So thank you, and Godspeed.